that question again, will you, Bert?
What time is this coming back?
How's that?
What time is these things that we're studying now coming back?
At what time these trumpets are sounding, is that it?
Yes.
Well, now that
brings us back to what we learned at the first, the division of the book. Three things. First, things that thou sawest. Things that you saw. Then, what's the next division?
Things that are.
Things that are. And then things that shall come to pass after these, or hereafter. All right. The things that John had seen are found in chapter 1. He saw the vision of the Son of Man in the midst of seven golden candlesticks. And he gave him a commission to write. It says, write that for the things which thou sawest. The things that are. The things that are, that was, those were the church conditions of that time. And church conditions of all time. The church conditions of the present time. You can see that. And I put down seven churches. Well, just put down chapter 2 and 3. And then things that shall come to pass after these, or hereafter. That begins with chapter 4. And runs on down to 22, the rest of the book, except the epilogue. Now, beginning with the 4th chapter, he tells us of things that shall come to pass after these. After what? After the things that are. Some think that those things began to come to pass soon after John was writing, and they try to trace it through history and find the fulfillments. And I think the outcome of that is pitiful. They try to show you, for instance, the first, here comes the opening of the seven seals in the 5th chapter. First seal is opened, and there comes this rider on a white horse. Well, Barnes, in his commentary, he shows that under the reign of the Emperor Trajan and some others, there was peace and prosperity. And he says, what could fit more wonderfully to the rider of the white horse than that? I can find a lot of other things that might fit just as wonderfully. Not a question of what would fit. And suppose that was the reign of Trajan. What would I care? What would you care? What would it mean to us? Nothing at all. And we had yesterday, when the angel had the key of the abyss, the sounding of the 5th trumpet, the angel had the key of the abyss, opened the abyss, and it comes out of it the smoke. And out of that smoke, locusts. Very strange locusts. And they had over them the king of the pit. The sword of the abyss was the prison house of evil spirits. What do you think they make of that? Oh, that was the invasion of the Saracens. Well, those locusts had orders that they should continue 5 months. That's right, 5 months, 30 days of the month, and every day stands for a year, 150 years. That's how long they continued. Did they? First place, that's not accurate.
then they tell us that those seraphims are those locusts. If that's what it means, of course, nobody could understand any of it. I think the historical interpretation has done more to confuse people and to perplex them and cause them to push the book of Revelation aside than almost anything else. Now, there may be things you know that have happened that might resemble some of the things that the book of Revelation tells us are going to come to pass in the future. That's not strange. If history repeats itself, I guess prophecy could too. But we're not to think that these things began to come to pass right after John's time of writing. They come to pass after the church period in which we are now living. And you'll notice that after chapter 3, the church isn't mentioned anymore at all, not by name, until you come down to the epilogue. Doesn't that strike you as being worthy of notice? The church is not mentioned anymore after the third chapter. Mentioned 19 times in chapter 1, 2, and 3. And then not another reference to her. At least not by name. She's not mentioned anymore. Till you get down to the epilogue, that verse we read a while ago, where it says, I've made known these things to the churches. And while the book doesn't tell us so, it would be very much in place and very fitting to think that right here is a time when the Lord Jesus comes down and the saints of the church are caught up to meet him in the air. And then these things come to pass afterwards. The first thing that John sees is a throne. And you remember it was a throne of judgment, not a throne in the ordinary sense. But a time has come for God to rise up and judge. You have something similar in the 7th chapter of Daniel, where he follows the line of prophecy. Very much in the same way that Revelation does. Read Daniel 7:9. Who has it? All right, Paul.
And he held from place, the one that was in the days, who said, the dragon was white snow, the hair of his head like pure wool, strong as fire, flame, and the room thereof burning fire.
Now that's the first thing he saw. He saw this throne of judgment. Out of that throne come lightnings and thunders and cries, voices. But there's a rainbow around about the throne, foretokening a better day. Then, on the right hand of him that sits on the throne, in the right hand, he sees a scroll, securely sealed with seven seals. And an angel challenges the universe. Who is able, who is worthy to take that book out of the hand of the Almighty and to open the seals thereof? And there was not a created being anywhere that could do that. John wept. One of the elders said to him, don't weep. Behold, the Lion of the tribe of Judah, the root of David, has overcome to open to take the book and open the seals thereof. And the Lion of the tribe of Judah turns out to be a lion with the marks of death on him, as though he'd been slain. And he goes up to the throne of God to take it out of his hand. And then the whole welcome breaks loose in praise from the top gallery down to the lowest basement. Everything breaks forth in praise. John knew what that book meant. It meant the final carrying out of God's purpose. For a long time God has been silent, as he is silent today. Satan has had the upper hand
evil is rampant. There have always been some of God's people here during this time. There have been some churches, but not too many. And as the end comes, will there be more or fewer?
Fewer.
That's right. When the Son of Man comes. And things were looked pretty dark. But now the time has come. He rises up for judgment. The seven seals are opened. They give you kind of a general view of the things that shall come to pass. The sixth seal especially tells you of the great and terrible day of the Lord. And then come the seven trumpets. The first, second, third, and fourth seals, the four horsemen of the apocalypse. Then the fifth and sixth seal, between the sixth and the seventh, the parenthesis. Then come the angels with the seven trumpets. First, second, third, and fourth, they stand off to themselves. The fifth and sixth, and then a parenthesis again. We saw that yesterday. The great angel that sets one foot on the sea and the other on the earth and raises his hand to heaven and swears that there should be no more delay. But in the days when the seventh angel is about to sound, then is finished the mystery of God according to the word of the prophets. And the second part of this parenthesis is a vision in Jerusalem and two witnesses that are preaching. Those witnesses are slain at last when their work was done, not before, but when their work was done, the beast that comes up out of the abyss, first time is mentioned, we learn more about it afterwards, he puts them to death, but after 3 days and a half, they're raised up. And then comes the sounding of the seventh trumpet. Now, Barrett's question is, when are we to look for that? We don't look for it at all. What we look for is the Lord Jesus coming after his church. These are things that are to befall the world. And they show us the final culmination of God's work. It's like this. We are living in a special age now. Call it the gospel age and the church age. God is dealing with men in grace. Satan is not in the saddle. God's people are being troubled and persecuted. And this will continue until the Lord descends from on high and the saints are caught up. The dead are raised, that is, dead in Christ. And the living have changed and caught up to meet him in the air. Now then, that influences the fall from the earth. And evil then comes to its full force. Things are bad and worse. Here comes in the great tribulation. Here comes in the beast. During this time, the seven trumpets are sounded. And as we learn later, seven bowls of wrath are poured out. And then finally the Lord Jesus comes. As you read the 19th chapter, beginning with verse 11, he doesn't come by himself though, his church comes with him. And here comes in conflict, the final showdown between God and his power and the powers of evil, the beast, false prophet, the kings of the earth, their armies gathered together to face him, to fight against him that is coming in on the white horse. After that comes the reign of 1,000 years. Here comes in judgment, and then comes the reign of 1,000 years, as we find in chapter 20, verses 1 to 6. So, we are not living in the days of the trumpets. We are not living in the days of the seals. Those are things that shall come to pass hereafter, after these future things. From chapter 4 on, everything is future. They had a time trying to find a time when that throne appears and when the Lamb takes the book after John's day. The historical interpreters try to make it this or that. That's all foolish. And remember, too, incidentally, that just to show that a certain event fits a prophecy, there's no proof at all that that's the fulfillment. You might find something that fits wonderfully, and yet might not be the fulfillment at all. I try to show that to my class once, just to show how ridiculous it is. I took the four beasts of Daniel's prophecy in the seventh chapter of Daniel. The first beast was a lion, the second bear, the third was a leopard, the fourth was a ten-horned beast. And I made all four of them fit the United States just wonderfully. Just to show how foolish that kind of interpretation is. So don't have anything to do with that. Johnson's commentary, Barnes's commentary, many of the other commentaries, they bank on the historical fulfillment, and it isn't any fulfillment. It's nothing that you can depend on. We believe that these things will come to pass just as he tells us in the book of Revelation, that the Lamb takes up in heaven, that he takes that book, and then the repercussions are seen here upon the earth. The white horse, and the red horse, and the black horse, and the pale horse. And then in the fifth seal, those saints that have been slain. Because during this time, as we shall see in today's lesson also, during this time there will be converted Israel. And that those of Israel will also make other converts. And there will be a lot of persecution. A lot of them will have to die on account of it. And it's the souls of those that are crying for vengeance, or rather for justice. And then the sixth chapter, which portrays the great and terrible day of the Lord. Now let's turn to the 11th chapter. Very important passage now. Read verse 14. Let you read, Brother McGee.
But war is past, and all the third war cometh quickly.
That points back to 8:13. Read that. The last three trumpets.
I saw and I heard an eagle flying in mid heaven, saying with a great voice, woe, woe, woe. For them that dwell on the earth, by reason of the other voices of the trumpet of the three angels who are yet to stand.
Well, the first of those three woes is found in the ninth chapter, where the fifth angel sounds. The second of those woes is found in verse 13 of the ninth chapter, where the sixth angel sounds. And now the seventh angel is to sound. The second woe is past. Behold, the third woe, the last woe, comes quickly. Now let's see what happens here. You know, the angel in the 10th chapter, what did he say, Brother Delmer? Read the verse of the 10th chapter. Read verses 5 to 7.
And if any man desireth to hurt you, far proceedeth out of their mouth and devour their enemy. And if any man shall desire to that pleasure. And the angel that I saw standing upon the sea and upon the earth lifted up his right hand to heaven, and swear by him that lives forever and ever, to create the heavens and the things that are therein, and the earth and the things that are therein, and the sea and the things that are therein, that there shall be delay no longer. But in the days of the voice of the seventh angel, when he is about to sound, then is finished the mystery of God, according to the good tidings which he declared to his servants, the prophets.
So this angel predicts, it says, that when the seventh angel sounds, then is finished the mystery. A mystery is always something that's hidden, unrevealed. God's been working in a mysterious way. His wonders to perform. That's what we call providence, providential government. Don't make any mistake about that. He's got his fingers on everything. Everything is being worked and woven into his pattern. I saw a poem once. I can't repeat the poem, but I'll tell you what it said. It showed the mystic weaver sitting at the loom. Did you ever see a weaver sitting at the loom? Well, he picks up shuttles, different colors of thread, and shoots them in, right and left. Some black, some silvery, some red, and some yellow, and so on. And it doesn't make any sense. You look at what he's doing, it doesn't look like anything at all. But when he finishes his work, he cuts the tapestry off from the loom, turns it over, and here's the perfect pattern. He knows what he's doing, and been doing that all the time. He has his fingers on everything. You see it all through the Bible. Nothing really happens by accident. God is working. He lets the devil do his devilishness. He lets the wicked do wickedness. He lets the righteous do righteousness. And it seems that everything is just going by haphazard. But when he gets through, you'll see that all along he's been working to a certain end. He never forgets. Neither in the life of the individual, nor in the life of nations, nor in the life of the world at large, God is working to bring about his purpose. Our hymn says that God moves in a mysterious way, his wonders to perform. He plants his footsteps in the sea and rides upon the storm. Deep in unfathomable minds of never failing skill, he treasures up his bright designs and works his sovereign will. Ye fearful saints, fresh courage take. The clouds you so much dread are big with mercy and will break in blessings o'er your head. Blind unbelief is sure to err and scan his works in vain. God is his own interpreter and he will make it plain. So God's been working providentially. You can't see his hand, but his hand is there all the time. In a way that we can trace, as Paul says, how unsearchable are his knowledge, is his knowledge, and his ways past tracing out. And the people of the world are perfectly blind. The unbelieving science of the day goes on the principle that God never does anything. He never interferes in the working of natural law as cause and effect all along, and God doesn't do anything. And many people in the world don't take God into account at all. They just think it's just what they do, what they want to do, and so forth. Well, after they have done their worst or their best, they'll find out that they fitted right into the plan of God. For better or for worse, or for good or for evil. That's God's working in mystery. But when the seventh angel sounds, he says, that mystery will be finished. And God will come out in the open then. And will begin to act on his own in such a way that people know that it's he. When the seventh angel sounds, then read Miss Lois, verse 15.
And the seventh angel sounded, and there followed great voices in heaven, and they said, the kingdom of the world is become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever.
Yes, sir. Now it's made open and plain that the kingdom is turned over to the Lord and to his Christ. It's not yet accomplished, but
the great deed has been done. It's announced, and it's going to come to pass. A man playing chess, if he is a very fine chess player, playing with somebody else, he makes a move, and he says, that settles the game. The man on the other side says, I don't see how. You haven't won the game. All right, go ahead and play. And said, it's all settled now. I have to move, make that move. And so this settles it. This settles it for good. It's just sure. Just if you, for instance, you had some kind of important transaction, contract, or something like that, and you're requested to answer that by mail, and you write out your answer and drop it in the box, say, now that's done. No, not yet. No, not until he gets the letter and sees it and maybe makes a move or two, but then the mailing of that letter settles it, doesn't it? And so, now the thing is settled. The seventh angel sounds, and the mystery is dispelled, and God comes out in the open. God has made bare his holy arm. Find that expression in Isaiah. He made bare his holy arm. The arm has been there all the time, been working, but now he strips it bare so that people can see that he is doing the work. Well, when that announcement is made, the kingdom of the world has become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ. He shall reign forever and ever. Let me ask here, has that ever come to pass? What do you think? Look at that verse and tell me. What do you think, Alice? Ever come to pass? Did the kingdom of the world ever become the kingdom of the Lord and of his Christ? No. Not so today, is it? You're not ruling in Russia, is it? Not a bit of it, nor even the United States and the other countries of the world. The kingdoms of the world are under Satan's domination now. But now when the seventh angel sounds, the whole thing is turned over to him. That is, that's the announcement only. The outworking comes in the following chapters. Well, when that happens, the 24 elders worship God. They're overwhelmed when they see God's great work. Verse 16 and 17, Miss Betty.
And the 24 elders who sit before God on their thrones fell upon their faces and worshiped God, saying, we give thee thanks, O Lord God, Almighty, and who art, because thou hast taken thy great power and thy strength.
Because thou hast taken thy great power and didst strength. Didn't he have it all the time? But now he has asserted it in such a way too that could be seen he has taken over all along his work, but now he really seizes his power and asserts it and really reigns, rules and reigns in the world. And the 18th verse shows what leads up to it, what led up to it, what happened, and what the outcome will be. Read verse 18, Sister Claire.
And the nations were wroth, and unrest came, and the time of the dead to be judged, and the time to give their reward to thy servants the prophets, and to the saints unto them that fear thy name, the small and the great, and to destroy them that destroy the earth.
Thy wrath came, the nations were wroth. In the second psalm, we have a comment on that. Why do the nations rage and the peoples meditate a vain thing? The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against Jehovah and against his anointed, saying, let us break their bonds asunder and cast away their cords from us. They're saying that in Russia now and many other places. Here's God's answer. He that sitteth in the heaven will laugh. The Lord will have them in derision. Then will he speak unto them in his wrath, and vex them in his sore displeasure. Yet I have set my king upon my holy hill of Zion. And what does the king say there? Verses 7 to 9, you read, Patsy? Oh, you haven't got it? Who has it? All right, Judy. And the last part of the psalm is good advice. You better knuckle to that. You better come under. Well, the nations were wroth, and thy wrath came, and the time of the dead to be judged. That's seen finally in the 20th chapter. The time to give a reward to thy servants, the prophets, and to the saints, and to them that fear thy name, the small and the great, and to destroy them that destroy the earth. That means then that all the wicked powers that have destroyed God's good earth will be removed and be destroyed. During the last world war, the hordes of Hitler, they made a boast of the devastated and burned earth that they left behind. They just ruined it and destroyed it. Well, war does a great deal of that everywhere. That'll be a thing of the past. God is saying, now that's plenty of that. Now after this thanksgiving in heaven, read verse 19. What happens there, Brother?
And there was opened the temple of God that is in heaven, and there was seen in his temple the ark of his covenant. And there followed lightnings and voices and thunders, and an earthquake and great hail.
And he's going to tell now how the kingdom comes in to take control of God's kingdom, the Lord Jesus Christ, the great cleanup that'll follow, and how he'll take possession. But before he does that, there comes a parenthesis. You remember what we said about a parenthesis, what a parenthesis is? It's something that's not directly connected with what went before and what follows after, just as you have it here and there. But here is a great parenthesis. From chapter 12, 1, down to chapter 15, 5. That's the biggest parenthesis in the chapter. That gives you the stage setting. It shows you what's going on all this time here upon the earth, before the Lord actually takes a hand. This just gives you a view of all the affairs on the earth and some of the heavenly things to connect it. After which, he takes control. Read that 19th verse again, Miss Elson.
And there were opened the temple of God that is in heaven, and there was in the temple the ark of his covenant. And there followed lightnings and voices and thunders and an earthquake and great hail.
And a great hail. Now turn to the 15th chapter and the 5th verse, Brother Teddy, and you read there.
And after these things I saw in the temple of the tabernacle, the testimony in heaven was open.
Yeah. Now, you notice in 15:5, he takes up exactly where he left off at 11:19. See, at 11:19, he sees that there was opened the temple of God that is in heaven, and there was seen in his temple the ark of his covenant. At 15:5, he goes back to that. After these things I saw in the temple of the tabernacle, the testimony in heaven was opened. So everything between is of the nature of a parenthesis, giving you the stage setting of things that are happening on the earth. Now let's see what all is happening. The first thing he sees is a great sign. Sign is not a literal thing, it's a symbol of something. He sees a woman, and she is arrayed most marvelously. She is clothed in the sun, and the moon is under her feet, and a crown of 12 stars on her head. And she cries out, traveling in death, to be delivered. A second sign, a great red dragon who has 7 heads and 10 horns, and on his heads diadems, and his tail draweth the third part of the stars of heaven. Stars are always prominent personages. The stars in the first chapter are the angels of the 7 churches. Lord Jesus himself is called the bright and morning star. That dragon wraps his tail around 1/3 of the stars. Satan pulled down angels with him, a great multitude, when he fell. We'll see about that presently. But the child was born and was caught up to heaven. And the dragon was spoiled in his attempt to destroy the child. And then he turns his attention to the woman. Next time you see her, she is stripped of all her glory. She is a poor fugitive here on the earth, and the devil, the dragon, pursuing her. Well, we'll see about this now. Read the verses 1 and 2. Will you read, Judy, of the 12th chapter?
In the great stars between the heavens, a woman arrayed with the stars and the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars. She sees the child, and she cries out, trembling in birth and in pain and delivery.
What's the other sign that he sees? Read 3 and 4, Sharon.
And there was seen another sign in heaven. And behold, a great red dragon, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and upon his head 7 diadems. And his tail draws the third part of the stars of heaven, and is cast them to the earth. And the dragon standeth before the woman that is about to be delivered, that when she is delivered, he may devour her child.
Yeah. And verse 5.
And she was delivered of the son, a man child, who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron. And her child was caught up unto God, and he was born.
Yes, sir. Next thing, you see that woman, a fugitive here on the earth. Read verse 6.
Since the woman fled into the wilderness, where she had a place prepared of God, that there they may nourish
her 1,260 days. Yes. There's your 1,260 days again, 1,260 days. Same thing as 42 months, 3 years and a half. Or time, times, and half time. Those expressions are synonymous. He gives all these different expressions to it, so as to show us that he means really that. Well, now the question is about that woman. Who is she that is clothed in the sun with the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars? Who is she? She brings forth a child that is to rule the nations with a rod of iron. Now Sice, who is a very good commentator and tells you many good things, is hopelessly astray on this point. That's because he never has understood really what the church is. He says that woman is the church. Did the church give birth to Christ?
No.
Surely no. Who did give birth to Christ?
Israel.
Christ came out of Israel. As Paul says, according to the flesh, he came of Israel. Well, this woman is Israel. Once before, sun, moon, and stars are used emblematically of Israel in one of Joseph's dreams. We don't need to turn to that now. Well, the dragon has seven heads. We learn later on that those heads are not contemporaneous. He never has but one head at a time. But each one of those heads signified the worldwide government. And in the symbol of the sign in heaven, John sees him with all his seven heads, and on each of the heads a diadem, a crown of a reigning king, and 10 horns. The horn is always a symbol of power. He draws the third part of the stars of heaven, and when the woman brings forth her child, he is caught up unto God and unto his throne. And now suddenly in verse 6, what does it say in verse 6 there? Read that again, Jerry.
And the woman said unto the Lord, where she had a place prepared beside that there.
See, the woman that was so gloriously apparelled, arrayed with the sun, the moon under her feet, and the crown of 12 stars on her head, now is seen as a poor fugitive on the earth. In verse 6, what has happened? Something has come in between. Now we'll find out what came in between. So read verse 7 and 8. Read next.
Make it.
There was war in heaven, of all things. If there should be a place where there is peace and nothing but peace, it would be in heaven, wouldn't it? There's war in heaven. Well, the reason of that is, I mean, the explanation of that is, that heaven is not just one place, but heaven has compartments. The Jews had the three heavens. The first heaven, where the clouds float, and where the birds fly. The second heaven, where the stars shine. The third heaven, where God is. Remember in the 12th chapter of 2 Corinthians, Paul was caught up to the third heaven, to the paradise of God, and saw things that were not, heard things that were not lawful to utter. Well, we wouldn't think that that war took place up here, but it would take place in this lower region. Spiritual sphere, all right, but it's not in the high heavens. We read of the Lord Jesus when he ascended. He was made higher than the heavens. He passed through the heavens. Heaven is not just one place. When Solomon built the temple, he said, will God indeed dwell in this house which I have built? As behold the heaven, and the heaven of heavens cannot contain thee, how much less this house which I have built. So heaven has different compartments in it. And here a conflict takes place between Michael, the archangel. Michael is specially related to Israel. He is the tutelary spirit, tutelary angel, taking care of Israel. Michael has angels under his control. Michael and his angels fighting against the dragon and his angels. What's the result of that, Suen? Verse 9.
And the great dragon was cast down, the old serpent, he that is called the devil and Satan, who is the deceiver of the whole world. He was cast down to the earth, and his angels were cast down with him.
Yes. So that's what happened. Here he tells you who's the dragon boss, so you don't have to guess. Who is he? Mm-hmm. The devil, that's right. The old serpent, why is he called that? Why is he called the old serpent?
Because of the Garden of Eden.
He tempted Eve, yes. Of course, that's easy. And he that is called the devil and Satan, really the word devil, Diabolos in the Greek means a slanderer. He slanders God to men. He slanders men to God. Slander is one of his great weapons. Don't fall in his ways with him. And he is the deceiver of the whole world. That would mean that not a single human being escapes his deception. All of us have been more or less affected by it at one time and another. The gospel undeceives people. The gospel lifts the veil and tells us the truth. But Satan's lie prevails everywhere. Everywhere. The story was told of a prankster that crept into a department store and changed all the price labels on things in the window and in the store. The valuable things, he put a cheap price on, and the comparatively worthless things, he put a high price on. So I guess you could buy a television machine for $1.50. And an old coffee can would cost you $350. Changed all those tags. You can imagine what the confusion that raised. The devil does that all the time. He puts a high tag on things that are worthless, and that'll disappoint. And he holds cheap the things that are really worthwhile. And what shall it profit a man if he shall gain the whole world and lose his own soul? What shall a man give in exchange for his soul? He is the deceiver of the whole world. Has been working on that. And the only undeception that you get is through the word of God. Sanctify them into truth. Thy word is truth. Now, when Satan is cast down, a great voice is heard in heaven. Read verse 10, Sylvia.
And I heard a great voice in heaven say, "Now comes salvation from the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ. For the accuser of our brethren is cast down, who accuses them before our God day and night."
Now has come, and Satan is cast down, the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ. For the accuser of our brethren is cast down, who accuseth them before our God day and night. And then he tells us why, how it became possible to cast him down. That's because somebody down here on the earth did something which made it possible for Michael and his angels to oust Satan out of his heavenly realm. That they overcame him. Read verse 11, Alice.
And they overcame him because of the word of the Lamb, and because of the word of the Christian. And they
loved
after
life in his death. Yes. They overcame him on account of three things, Alice. What was the first one? The blood of the Lamb, good. And what's the next one?
The
word of that testimony. What's the third?
They loved their lives.
They didn't love their lives even unto death. They were willing to die. if necessary. And therefore, verse 12, George.
Therefore rejoice, O heaven, and ye that dwell in them. Woe for the earth and for the sea, because the devil is gone down unto you, having great wrath, knowing that he hath but a short time.
In heaven there is great gladness, but woe to the earth and to the sea, because the devil is gone down unto you, having great wrath, knowing that he hath but a short time. And now the devil's going to raise such a trouble as has never been raised before. Turn to the 12th chapter of Daniel and read the first verse. Daniel 12:1. All right, Mary.
In the second time, the wife will stand up, the great prince, standing for the children of thy people. And there shall be a time of trouble, such as never was since there was a nation, even today.
See, Daniel and the Revelation are on the same track, aren't they? At that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince who standeth for the children of thy people. He is the great prince that stands for Israel. And there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since there was a nation, even to that same time. And at that time thy people shall be delivered, every one that shall be found written in the book. Here he says, woe for the earth and the sea, because the devil has gone down unto you, having great wrath. That means he's going to start that tribulation such as never has been before, and never will be again. And now you get the explanation of verse 6. Read verse 6, and then read verse 13. Whose time is it? Yours, Barrett?
Verse 6,
chapter
12. And the woman fled to the wilderness, for she had the place prepared of God, that there they may nourish her 1,260 days.
Yes. Read verse 13 and 14 too with it now.
And when the dragon saw that he was cast down to the earth, he persecuted the woman that brought forth the man child. And there was given to the woman the two wings of the great eagle, that she might fly to the wilderness unto her place, for she is nourished for a time and half a time.
Yeah.
From the face of the serpent.
Notice how time, times, and half a time is equivalent to what it says in verse 6, 1,260 days. That means 3.5 years. The serpent tries very hard to engulf that woman, but somehow things work against him. Verses 15 and 16. Read next, Sister Covet.
And the serpent cast out of his mouth after the woman the water of the river, that he might cause her to carry away the stream.
Did you read 16 also?
No. And the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened her mouth and swallowed up the river which the dragon cast out of his mouth.
And the devil gets madder and madder. Read verse 17 next, brother. You read.
And the dragon was wroth with the woman, and went to make war with the raiment of her seed, which kept the commandments of God, and had the testimony of Jesus Christ.
And he stood upon the sand of the sea. The dragon did. And there, by his conjuring, he raises up something that comes up out of the sea, a beast with 10 horns, a very vicious thing, resembling absolutely the fourth beast of Daniel's vision in the 7th chapter of Daniel. We'll learn about him next time. Now, has this been pretty clear to us? I was bringing out a point once in class, and one of the young men saw the point, and he saw it was true. He says, Brother Bull, how long did it take you to see that? Oh, well, maybe 10 years. You expect us to see it in 10 minutes? Oh, yeah, why not? It was going to take as long as it did me, was the use of my teaching. So, if I've spent time on it, I can point out some things to you that you wouldn't have seen so well for yourself. I'm trying to point out these things to you so you can get them clear in your mind. And when we get through, you'll think the book of Revelation is just a very lucid and wonderful book in many ways. Helpful and strengthening and encouraging. And it tells us about the destiny of things. And that makes things worthwhile for us. Well, we'll pick it up then at the 13th chapter next Monday. That's a long time off. That's down in stand and ask the Lord's blessing and our coming together this evening, that the class may be helpful to us all, giving us an understanding of the things of God. We have some sick folks to pray for. Sister Virgil Whitenick, Sister Trice, and Sister Lily Shanks, we could remember her, Sister Lily Campbell. Just ask the Lord to bless those whose names have been mentioned if you can't remember them. Shall we stand? Brother Hayden, will you? Miss Ray and Judy Ann, Philip Bornwasser. I wonder if Philip isn't able to come yet. Miss Lurer. She'll be here. Ted Brackett and Elsa.
Ted will be here.
Ted coming here. Delma Browning, Sister Covey, Lois Campbell, Mona Bell, Sister Hart, Paul Hyatt, Sister Hart's present, isn't she? Sharon Hyde, Brother Knecht, Sister Knecht, excused today. Miss Betty, Charles, Mary, Mickey, Paul, Louise, Chester the Hugh, can't be here today, he's told me. Bernard Lawyer, Eugene McGee, Lois McReynolds, dual means, can't come here always. Neither can Sister Mercer, Judy Radford, Jerry Dale Redmond, George Ridge, Sue Ann Hurd, Sue Ann present. Sister Strickland, Gordon Kay, Virginia Sue, Lewin Wynn, Sylvia, Sylvia Wynn present.
Yes.
Alvin, you're. And what's your name? You'll have to write that for me. You'll be in the class after this, brother.
Yes.
Good. What's your first name, Brother Hayden?
Alfie.
He'll let you write it out. Don't want to make a mistake. Well, we're coming to a very, very important chapter. Jerry Davis. All right. That's one of the key chapters, the 13. But in order to get the real point of it, we'd have to look back over the 12th chapter again. In the 12th chapter, well, in fact, we have to go a little bit back to that. Mm-hmm.
Here are the seals, and here are the trumpets, and then 3, 4, 5, 6, parentheses 7. There's that symmetry. These are the 6, 7 seals. 6 of them are open. Then comes parentheses 7. Then the trumpets. 6 of them sound. Then comes parentheses. And then the 7. You understand what the parenthesis is? It's something that's set off from the rest. Just like often in our talk, while we're saying something, we stop to explain and then go on. And here are the bowls of wrath. 7 of them. 6 are poured out, then the parenthesis, and then the 7. In all these series, the first 4 are always distinguished from the last 3 for some reason. Well, this is the course of the book, this and this and this. But in between comes a parenthesis, the longest parenthesis of the book, in which he stops to tell us what's going on all the time while this is happening. There's a situation, a kind of scenery, a stage setting. And he stops to tell us what is going on in the world. The while the seals are being broken, the trumpets are being sounded, and the bowls are being poured out. Have such some things going on in the world that have to do with the pouring out of those judgments and the sounding of those trumpets. This is the parenthesis thing, beginning with chapter 12, verse 1. The first thing he sees in chapter 12 is the vision of the sun-clad woman. Let you read, Sister Covey.
And a great sign was seen in heaven, a woman arrayed with the sun and the moon under her feet, and upon her head a crown of 12 stars. And she was a child, and she cried out, traveling in birds, and came to be delivered.
Now take up verse 3 and 4, Miss Lois.
And there was seen another sign in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and upon his head 7 dragons. And his tail draws the 3rd part of the stars of heaven, and is cast into the earth. And the dragon standeth before the woman that is about to be delivered, that when she is delivered, he may devour her child.
In verse 5, Brother Vernon.
And she was delivered of a son, a man child, who is to rule all the nations with a rod of iron, and her child was caught up unto God and unto his throne.
Now he says he saw these signs in heaven. They are symbolical figures. They're not literal personages, but they're symbolical figures. That is the way they're represented. There's not a literal dragon, and the woman that's seen there is a symbolic representation of something. So is her child. Well, the woman is very gloriously arrayed. She is clothed in the sun. The moon is under her feet. And a crown of 12 stars on her head. She is about to give birth. She crieth out in pain, travel to be delivered. The dragon is a horrible beast, like an alligator with wings, and they usually represent it as breathing flame and fire.
And he wraps his tail around the third of the stars and pulls them down to himself. That's a symbolic figure. It stands for something. And we are told later on exactly who the dragon is. We also learn who the woman is, what is meant by the woman. Also, we know who the child is. The woman, so gloriously arrayed, is suddenly seen as a poor fugitive. In verse 6, read that, Brother. Okay.
And the woman fled into the wilderness, where she had a place prepared of God, that there they may nourish her 1,260 days.
You notice that same woman now that had been seen in heaven, the sign in heaven, in the spiritual sphere, an ideal representation of something. That same woman is seen now on the earth. And she is in distress. She is fleeing into the wilderness where she has a place prepared of God. What does it all mean? Well, the woman, as the connection shows, is Israel. You find her associated in Joseph's dream with the sun, moon, and stars in the 37th chapter of Genesis. Read the 9th and 10th verses. Who has that? Well, Mickey, you have it. Go ahead and read it for us.
He dreamed yet another dream, and told to his brethren.
Now read loud enough for me to hear you.
Behold, I have dreamed yet a dream. Behold, the sun and the moon and the 11 stars made obedience to me. And he told it to his father and to his brethren. And his father rebuked him and said to him, what is this dream that I have dreamed? The lion, thy mother, and thy brethren indeed come to bow down ourselves to thee.
Jacob, interpreting Joseph's dream, takes it to mean that he and his mother and his brethren are represented by the sun, moon, and stars. 11 of the stars bowed down before him. That's the hint that we have in the Old Testament as to the woman that is clothed in the sun and has the moon under her feet and has a crown of 12 stars. But of course we couldn't depend on that for identification, but you'll find out presently what it is. That child that was born is destined to rule the nations with a rod of iron. And you'll know at once who that child is, what is meant by that child. Who then is the woman that brings forth that child? Where did Christ come from?
Of the Jews. Israel.
Came from Israel. Yes. That woman is Israel. The Roman Catholics, of course, they try to make that the Virgin Mary, but they have a hard time making it fit. But then, you know, when you're set on doing something, why, you will do it somehow. But it wouldn't fit the Virgin Mary. In fact, Virgin Mary is a literal woman, whereas these are symbolic figures, the woman and the dragon, the stars, and the child. But we know that the child is the Christ. Not only the Christ himself, but who else besides him is given the right to rule the nations with a rod of iron?
The church.
What?
The church.
The church, that's right. Christ and the church are so united that sometimes they're spoken of as with one name. For instance, he is the vine, they are the branches. The vine includes the branches, doesn't it? Or look at 1 Corinthians 12:12. And notice how Christ and his church are spoken of as being one being, as it were. You have that, Jerry?
For as the body is one and hath many members, and all the members of the body being many are one body, so also is Christ.
So also is Christ, yes. Christ, members of his body and the members of the body, when they're spiritually conceived, they're represented as being the one Christ. Of course, that doesn't change the fact that the Lord Jesus is himself a self-contained person, and that he is in heaven now, and that he went to heaven. But this is a symbolic representation. The woman, the dragon, the stars, the child, they're symbolic signs. They're symbolic representations. Now that woman is certainly seen on the earth. What has happened? Something has happened to bring her into this state. And the answer is found in what follows in the rest of the chapter. There's war in heaven. Michael and his angels warring against the dragon. And the dragon's angels. The dragon is in heaven, that is, in the heavenly sphere. Remember, I call attention to you that heaven is not just one place, but it has different realms to it. And one of those realms is occupied by the dragon. But now the time has come to oust him. He's going to be deposed from that high place.
No more will Israel, when she flees into the wilderness, be repented toward God at this time or not?
Will she have repented toward God? Well, let's see about it. We'll come across that a little bit further on. I think... You probably will conclude that's the remnant of Israel, the faithful Israel. So Michael and his angels are fighting against the dragon and his angels. The dragon has angels. And notice he had, previously we are told that he wrapped his tail around a third of the stars and pulled them down there. His angels, those stars are. And what's the outcome of that war? Read verses 7 and 8. Your time.
It was given to him to make war with the saints before overcoming them. And it was given to him to...
You're reading 12:7, are you? Yeah.
And there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels going forth to war with the dragon. And the dragon warred and his angels, and they prevailed not, neither was their place found any more in heaven.
That's the outcome of that battle in heaven. A real battle. Not bloodshed, because they're not blooded beings, but there's a force exerted. Michael and his angels. And the dragon is cast down. In the 9th verse, then, Jared Davis, you read the 9th verse. We are told who the dragon is, so there can't be any mistake. He explains the symbol of the dragon now. No, a symbol is a figure. And he gives us the meaning of it now. In verse 9, go ahead.
And the great dragon was cast down, the old serpent. He that is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world.
He that is called the devil and... Satan.
Satan, the deceiver of the world, whole world, he was cast down to the earth, and his angels were cast down with him.
Yes, sir. That ends his occupancy in heaven. He still holds that spiritual realm, spiritual sphere, from which he controls things. But from here on now, he is cast down to the earth, has no more place in the heavenly realm. Right now, Christians are said to belong to the heavenly realm, the heavenlies, as you find in the letter of the Ephesians. That expression is found five times, heavenly places. And we are made to sit with Christ in heavenly places. Spiritually, the Christian is up there, belongs already to the heavenly realm. And there he encounters great enemies. Those enemies are described in Ephesians, the 6th chapter, 10th to 11th verses. Now who has that? Ephesians 6. Judy?
Finally, be strong in the Lord and in the strength of his heart. Put on the whole armor of God, and he will be able to stand against the wiles of the devil.
Well, that's not what I wanted.
12.
He says our wrestling is not against flesh and blood, but against the principalities and the powers.
Verse 12.
How's that?
Verse 12.
Verse 12.
Yeah.
Anyway, all right. Read that verse 12, Judy. Yes, in those heavenly places, in that spiritual realm, there are great foes that fight against us. The Christian doesn't have to contend against ordinary temptations only, but he has to fight against the principalities, against the powers, against the world rulers of this darkness, of this age of darkness, against the spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. Those spiritual hosts of wickedness are there, and Satan holds a place there in that heavenly realm. But now when Michael and his angels have gone forth, he is cast down from that place, and never again will he be there. Up to this time, up to the time this happens, he is in those heavenly places. You remember, for example, in the book of Job, it says that when the Lord called for his people, for his servants in heaven, Satan also was among them. In Job, the first chapter and the 6th verse, Job 1:6. All right, Judy. You see, there's something that's happening up there in heaven. The sons of God, they're always angels. That expression, B'nai Elohim in the Hebrew, always refers to angelic beings. Safe with him. He still held a place up there and holds it now and will hold it until Michael and his angels throw him down, cast him down to the earth. And the great dragon was cast down, the old serpent. He's called the old serpent because he's the serpent that deceived Eve by his craftiness. And he that is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world, he was cast down to the earth, and his angels were cast down with him. Now, when that happens, there's a great rejoicing in heaven. Heaven has been cleaned up now. Read verse 10. You read, Jerry.
Great voice in heaven saying, Now is come the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of the Christ.
Paul, go ahead.
our brethren is cast down, who accuseth them before our God, day and night.
Yeah. That is a great rejoicing in heaven, because the accuser of our brethren is cast down. He does that. He constantly throws it up to God that some of his people are doing things that are wrong. He accuses them before the throne of God. That's his business. Since we're turning to passages, let's turn to Zechariah, the 3rd chapter. Zechariah has a vision there. Read verses 1 and 2. Mary.
And he showed me Joshua, the high priest, standing before the angel of Jehovah, and Satan standing at his right hand to be his adversary. And Jehovah said unto Satan, Jehovah rebuked thee, O Satan. Yea, Jehovah that hath chosen Jerusalem rebuked thee. Is not this a branch plucked out of the fire?
And Satan standing at his right hand, Joshua the high priest, he's the representative of the people. And Satan is standing, he's represented there as being before God, an angel of Jehovah presenting him, and Satan at his right hand to be his adversary, to accuse him, to speak against him. He is the accuser of the brethren. He is still so. You may remember a little incident that I've told quite a number of times. We had a sister here in Louisville. She was a kind of a weak sister in several ways, and an elderly woman. And I helped her out once in regard to a serious matter. She came to church for a while, and then she stopped. I went to see her, and she began to tell me about the faults of all the church members. All, a lot of them, just hypocrites, plain hypocrites. And the brother that waits on the table, he's just, he is an outright hypocrite, worst kind of one. And there's Sister So-and-so, that she sits on the front seat, and she has a tongue like a bell clapping, and things like that. And I finally said to her, well, I'm sorry to hear you're in the devil's business. And she flew up at me. He says, how am I in the devil's business? I said, you don't know what the devil's business is. And I turned to this place and showed her that he is the accuser of the brethren. I said, you just right in his line, aren't you? And she had to shut up from that. Yes. You find that kind, they just help the devil out. And they're the accuser of the brethren. We have a hymn, when free from envy, scorn and pride, our wishes all above, each can his brother's failings hide and show a brother's love. For love covereth a multitude of sins. And where there's love, there's very little of that criticism. Sometimes it's necessary. He says that if you rebuke a man, elder, do it before the congregation. If it has come to that point, it might be necessary sometimes. But this common fault finding, that's wrong in the sight of God. I go to the little church at Wichita Falls, not a large congregation. But there's one thing that impressed me all through the years now that I've been there, and that is the way they love one another. And their faith and their love and their good works and their earnestness, they have some peculiarities, but they're not bad. They don't believe in Sunday school, and they don't have but one cup for the Lord's Supper. But on the whole, they represent the character and the attitude of a New Testament church.
You never hear any bad remarks made about anything. It's too bad when brethren have a scorn one for another. I went to a place once, and I stayed at the brother's home, and I asked him about such and such a brother. Oh yes, him. Well, he's small potatoes and few in the hill. And I thought there must be something wrong here. They can talk about one another like that. And well, there was something wrong. Now that's Satan's scheme. He is the accuser of the brethren, always finding fault. He did that with Job, you know, when God said, "Hast thou considered my servant Job, a perfect and an upright man, one that feareth God and turneth away from evil?" Satan says, "Oh yes, I know that kind. He knows which side of his bread is butter." Says, if you take away from him, he's been prosperous, and you've made a hedge about him. If you take his property away from him, he'd curse you to your face. See? That's Satan's attitude. The Lord said, "All right, I'll let you try it. Just take away all he's got. And see. And Satan went to work. His flocks, his herds, his servants, even his children were taken away from him. And Job rent his robe and shaved his head and sat down and said, "The Lord has given, the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." And the second time, when the sons of God assembled themselves before Jehovah, he said to Satan, he says, "Now, what do you think of Job, perfect and an upright man? And thou movest me against him, and to afflict him without cause." Says, "And he still holds fast his integrity." "Oh yes," said Satan, "you didn't let me touch his person. As long as people are in good health, they can stand most anything. But you wouldn't let me touch his person. But if you did, well, then he'd curse you to your face." God said, "All right, go ahead, try. But you mustn't take his life." And Satan smote him with sore boils from the crown of his head to the sole of his feet. He had to go outside the village. He sat on a heap, a dump heap, and scraped himself with a potsherd, scraped the corruption of his body. He was reduced to the last point of misery, but he came out of it a greater and a better and stronger man. And Satan was absolutely defeated. But that's Satan's great card that he plays. Oh yeah, hypocrites in the church, and this one is wrong, that one is wrong. And all that good talk and all that pretty songs and so forth, they don't mean anything. That's the devil's way. The accuser of our brethren is cast down. Who accuseth them before our God day and night. And the reason that was made possible was because something happened here on the earth. You'll find a constant interchange between heavenly scenes and earthly scenes. Things happen in heaven because of things that happen on earth. In heaven, certain measures are decided and certain steps are taken. But there's always the earthly cause for. And what do we read then in verse 10 about that, Charles?
"And I heard a great voice in heaven say,
no.
Now has come the salvation."
It's verse 11.
"And they overcame him because of the blood of the Lamb, and because of the word of their testimony, and they loved not their lives even unto death."
Yes, sir. There's somebody down here on the earth that resisted Satan. There are three grounds on which they won the victory. What is the first ground? By what means? Blood of the Lamb. Second?
Word of that testimony. The third.
Love not their life.
They were willing to die. And that gave them the victory. And when that victory was done up here, then Michael could win a victory up here. Michael was the angel, the great prince that saw after Israel. And when Israel became unfaithful and was given over to the Gentiles, then Michael went way back to Saddam. He just went into abeyance. He didn't do anything more. But now Michael rises up again. Turn to the 12th chapter of Daniel and read the first verse there. Daniel 12:1. All right, Paul.
At that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince, who stands for the throne of our people. And there shall be a time of trouble, such as no more since day. There will be a nation to use it at the same time. And at that time it is, our people shall be delivered. Everyone shall be found written in the book.
Hold that phrase a minute. Paul, what does it say about Michael? Who is he? The great prince that standeth for whom? For children. Children of thy people. Who are they? Israel. Yes. You know, Satan had angels that were superintending some of those nations, like Persia and others. God had appointed Michael to be the guiding spirit and power over Israel. Now, when Israel went bad, Michael just quit his job for the time being. And now, something has happened, and Michael stands up. And we learn here in Revelation what Daniel doesn't tell us, that Satan, the great adversary of Israel, is cast down to the earth. His angels are cast down with him. And now hold that phrase in Daniel 12:1, but read verse 12, Miss Lurie, of Revelation 12.
Therefore rejoice, O heaven, and ye that dwell in them. Woe for the earth and for the sea. Because the devil has gone down unto you, having great wrath, knowing that he hath but a short time.
Yeah. Woe for the earth and for the sea. There's joy in heaven for heaven being cleared out of that disgusting, wicked being. But now woe is to the earth and to the sea. There's trouble going to come here. Daniel tells us that same thing. Read again Daniel 12:1. Who has it? All right, would you read it, Sharon?
And at that time shall Michael stand up, the great prince who standeth for the children of thy people. And there shall be a time of trouble, such as never was since there was a nation, even to that time, that same time. And at that time thy people shall be delivered, every one that shall be found written in the book.
The result then of the casting down of Satan is joy in heaven, but the greatest trouble on earth that the earth has ever seen. Now we learn about that.
Brother Ball?
Yes, sir.
Isn't this the third woe?
The third woe is the sounding of the seventh trumpet.
This is the trouble in
that this is independent. This is an inset showing what's going on all the time. Really, this reaches clean back to the fifth chapter, fourth and fifth chapters. This has been the affairs of in the world. This is what's going on while the seals were opened and the trumpets were sounded, and when the bowls are poured out. This is the stage setting of the whole drama.
At what point is Satan cast down then?
At what point?
Is he cast down from the start?
Well, at the beginning, when Israel turns to the Lord, and when they overcame him, by the blood of the Lamb, by the word of their testimony, and because they love not their lives even unto death. It's in consequence of that Satan is cast down. And he says, now has come the kingdom. Well, the Lamb has taken the book in the fifth chapter, and that assures the whole outcome. There's the opening of the seals, the sounding of the trumpets, and then after that, the pouring out of the seven bowls of wrath. But in between the trumpets and the bowls of wrath comes this parenthesis, which gives us the lay of the land and shows us what's been going on the earth. Now, Satan is cast down. And what does he do in verse 13 and 14? Whose time is it? Yours, Sharon.
And when the dragon saw that he was cast down to the earth, he persecuted the woman that brought forth the man child.
Who is that woman, Sharon?
Israel.
Read on.
And the dragon said to the woman, the two wings of the great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness into her place, where she is nourished for a time and time and half a time from the face of the serpent.
The serpent makes an unsuccessful attempt to destroy the woman. In verses 15 and 16, Judy.
And the serpent cast out of his mouth unto the man and watered the rivers, that he might cause her to be carried away by the stream. And the earth helped the woman, and the earth opened her mouth and swallowed up the rivers which the dragon cast out of his mouth.
Yeah.
Did verse 16 happen in chapter 7 when the 12 tribes were sealed?
When 144,000 were sealed. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Did verse 15 happen then?
No, the sealing of those 144,000 guaranteed their preservation throughout the whole tribulation, at this time and any time after. This would be included in it. Did I answer you right? Or?
Well, I thought this 144,000 wouldn't be suffering anything. They'd be protected.
They'd be protected, yes, ma'am.
But would they be suffering and being persecuted?
They're among these that are being protected here. But you see, this is the first effort that he makes. And later on, he's more successful. If you read on a little further, he is more successful. Here he makes an effort to destroy Israel, but the earth helped and swallowed up the waters. That's a figurative expression. And then the dragon waxed angry. He was already angry as he could be. It says that he had great wrath, but in verse 12, he had great wrath, knowing that he had but a short time. Now his effort was spoiled of destroying Israel, and he is madder than ever. Read verse 17, Mary.
And the dragon waxed wroth with the woman, and went away to make war with the rest of her seed, that keep the commandments of God and hold the testimony of Jesus.
And undoubtedly they are her converts. That is, the converts of restored Israel, regenerate Israel, repentant Israel. They go out and they make converts far and near. And the dragon waxed wroth with the woman and went away to make war with the rest of her seed. Namely, those that keep the commandments of God and hold the testimony of Jesus. And he stood upon the sand of the sea. The old version says, I stood upon the sand of the sea. But the manuscript, the Sardis, shows that it ought to be, he stood upon the sand of the sea. This is a dragon deer. He stands on the seashore, and by some kind of magic power, occult power of his, he raises up a beast out of the sea. And that's the masterpiece of Satan's malice and wrong and wickedness and power. He is doing the very worst thing now that he could do, and that's plenty. Such a thing as he never has done before, and such a thing as will bring about the greatest suffering and the greatest tribulation that the world has ever seen. Let's look at that, see what happens. Read 13:1, Brother Delmer.
And I saw a beast coming up out of the sea, having 10 horns and 7 heads, and on his horns 10 diadems, upon his head the name of the blasphemy.
I saw a beast coming up out of the sea, having 10 horns and 7 heads, on his horns 10 diadems, and upon his heads names of blasphemy. He is like the firstborn of the beast in that he resembles him exactly, with a little difference. Notice what it says in verse 3 of this chapter, Miss Lurer. I mean, Miss Lois.
And I saw one of his heads as though it had been smitten.
The third verse of the 12th chapter.
The 13th
chapter. Can't you find it? The third verse of the 12th chapter. 12:3.
And there was seen another sign in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon, having 7 heads and 10 horns, and upon his head 7 diadems.
And notice that that beast is just a replica in those respects of the dragon. The dragon has 7 heads and has 10 horns. The dragon has seven diadems on his heads. The beast has 7 heads, but has the diadems on his 10 horns. That's significant. What the significance of it is, we won't try to explain now. But notice that. I saw a beast coming up out of the sea, having 10 horns. Did I tell you wrong a while ago, Miss Lois? I thought I told you to stick it in the same chapter. I meant the 12th chapter in the 3rd verse. The reason didn't find it. I saw a beast coming up out of the sea, having 10 horns and 7 heads, and on his horns 10 diadems, and upon his heads names of blasphemy. We are not told that about the dragon, but the beast has those names of blasphemy upon his heads. Blasphemy against God. Blasphemy is insulting speech, calling him vile names, evil things. Russians are doing that. Soon after they got into power, they issued a cartoon. It was spread all over the world, people everywhere to see. It represented the reds going up the ladder to heaven. God is sitting up there, represented as an elderly man with spectacles on, and the Son of God sitting by him. He said, now we have done away with the earthly stars, we're going to do away with the one that's up there in heaven. That's the blasphemy. That's scurrilous speech against God. The beast would be past master of that. He'll say all kinds of vile things. But that Bishop Oxenham that you hear of, you read about him once in a while in the papers, Bromley Oxenham, an out-and-out infidel modernist. And he told himself about something that his son, his boy, said to him when they read a chapter in the Old Testament. And the boy said to him, "Well, Father, I know you don't believe in that God, that dirty bully." And it seemed that Oxnam was pleased with that. He reprinted it and told him, "That's the name of blasphemy against the Almighty God." And that's one of the signs of our times. Well, that beast will have names of blasphemy on his heads. And he describes that beast. Read verse 2. Yeah, just verse 2, Brother George.
"And the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard, and his feet were as the feet of a bear, and his mouth as the mouth of a lion, and his breath gave him his paws, and his throne a great garden."
Yeah. Now we have to turn back to Daniel on this. The 12th chapter, the 7th chapter of Daniel. And buried, I guess you have it there. Read there, beginning with verse 2, and read down through verse 7 of Daniel 7.
"Daniel spake and said, I saw my vision by night, and behold, four winds of heaven break forth upon the great sea, and four great beasts came up from the sea, diverse one from another. The first was like a lion, and had an eagle's wing. I beheld to the wings that were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth, and made to stand up on 2 feet as a man, and a man's heart was given to it. And behold, another beast, the second, like to a bear, and it was raised up on one side, and 3 ribs were in its mouth between its teeth. And they said thus unto it, Arise, devour much flesh. After this I fell, and lo, another like a leopard, which had upon its back four wings of birds, beasts of its forehead, and wings were given to it. After this I saw in the night vision, and behold, a fourth beast, terrible and powerful, and a sea, and a strong sea, and it had great iron teeth, which devoured and brake in pieces, and sank beside them with its leaps. It was
diverse
from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns.
It had 10 horns. He sees a lion, and a bear, and a leopard, and a 10-horned beast coming up out of the sea. Now for the explanation. Who's sitting there behind you? Sylvie. Read in the 7th chapter of Daniel, read verses 17 and 18. Have you got it?
"Which are four kings that shall rise out of the earth, and the saints of the Most High shall be
king of
the
forever." These four beasts are four kings, four kingdoms that shall arise out of the earth. Then in verse 23, he wants to know especially about that the fourth beast. Well, in verse 19, and it tells us about that fourth beast and what he is doing. Now let's read verse 19 to 22 of the 7th chapter of Daniel.
"Then I divided from the truth concerning the fourth beast, which was merciful, and all men, exceeding terrible, his teeth of iron, and his nails of bread, which devoured and swayed his feet, and sank the rest of his feet. And concerning the same horns that were on his
feet." You can skip verse 20, read 21. And what's the explanation of that? You read next to the end, verse 23. He'll devour the whole earth and shall tread it down. Read verse 25, Brother Hayden, of Daniel 7.
And he shall speak words against the Most High.
That's where the blasphemy comes in, you know. Go ahead.
And shall wear out the saints of the Most High. And he shall think to change the times and the law. And they shall be given unto his hand until a time and
times half a time. And then comes the final issue of it, 26 and 27, Sister Hart. So that'll be the last world power, that ten-horned beast. Those four beasts Daniel saw, they represent four kingdoms. And the last one is especially vicious. And Daniel asked about him and tells what'll become of him, or what's going to happen. That fourth beast is destroyed by the power of the Most High. Well, we go now back to the 13th chapter of Revelation. And read again the second verse. You read, didn't it, Elsie?
And the beast which I saw was like unto a leopard, and his feet like unto a bear, and his mouth as the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him his power.
So that beast that comes up here in the 13th chapter of Revelation is identified with the fourth beast of Daniel. It's a ten-horned beast, the same one. These beasts represent world powers. The first great world, Gentile world power that had control over all the earth and over Israel was Babylon, wasn't it? Can someone tell me what the next one was?
Medo-Persia.
Medo-Persia. And what was the next one?
Greece.
Anyone?
Greece.
Greece, that's right. Under Alexander the Great. There was a fourth world power that we read of in the New Testament. These three are identified in Daniel. You don't have to go outside of Daniel for that. But you have to go to the New Testament for the fourth one. And which one is that? Aside from that, there has never been a world power. Various ones have tried, have endeavored to possess themselves of the world. Charles V of Spain tried. Napoleon tried. And the Reds are trying it now. They want to have world dominion. But there has never been another world power. But someone, well, before I mention that, you remember the story of Nebuchadnezzar's dream? Of the great image that stood there representing the four world powers. Says it was resplendent, terrible to look on, like my picture. Terrible to look on, too. But it was an awful thing. And he looked on it until the stone was loose from the mountain and smote the image on its feet and broke the whole thing. Not only the feet and the legs, which were of iron, but the belly and thighs of brass, arms of breast of silver, and the head of gold. The whole thing was broken in pieces together and made like the chaff of the winter's threshing floor, which means that in the end time, the last word power will be the combination of all these, the whole thing. And so, in the end time, Rome will be the fourth word power, but she'll be in a shape that she has never been in before. She never has had ten horns or tenfold division with the one man ruling over it. But she'll come back in that shape. And it's by the beast, the beast will come forth out of the sea, and he'll have the characteristics of all four. The lion of Daniel 7 represents this kingdom. The bear represents this one. The leopard represents this one. The ten-horned beast is the last one. Now when he describes it there in verse 2, he says that beast has the mouth of a lion, has the feet of the bear, has the general appearance of the leopard, but has the ten horns. He has all the characteristics of all four of them. It will come to its final complete perfection. And that's the way it's represented in Daniel, and we'll see it here too.
Brother Bull?
Yes, sir.
With the fact that Rome was in control of the world at the time of Christ, made the early apostles look for his coming right then?
Might have, but they didn't claim to know. But Rome passed out as a world power. But she wasn't stricken by a stone from heaven and powdered into small pieces. And its parts were separated, good large-sized parts, perpetuating her language, her customs, her jurisprudence, and forms of government. That's the way she exists now and until yet. But in the end time, she'll come forth in the shape in which she is described both in Daniel and Revelation, the shape which she's never had, the fourth world power.
Well, what element would it take to identify the fourth world power with Rome?
Now look at the second chapter of Luke. And read the first verse. You have it.
It came to pass in those days that there went out a decree from Caesar Augustus that all the world should be enrolled.
That shows that he had control of the world, didn't he?
My question was, what would it take to identify the world power when it comes with Rome?
Because there never was any other. Daniel just foresaw four of them. There wouldn't be five. And that was the only other world power that ever was. And she is still in existence in her parts, but not actually as a world power, but she's coming back as such. We'll see something of that a little bit further on. Well, now let's see how our time, is just about up. We'll have to take it up then tomorrow and see the great doings of that beast and how the great trouble eventuates from that. We're getting into the hot place now of the book of Revelation. That's intensely interesting and meaningful to us at this present time. These things are in the air now. For some years past, there has been a clamor for one world, world dominion.
Really, as a matter of fact, while Babylon was the world power, she never actually took possession of all the world, but she She had the power. Nobody but her sister. Same thing is true of near Persia. Same thing was true of Greece. And same thing is true of Rome. But now there's been a cry for one world, especially since the atomic bomb has come in. They have to have a central world government. Why? Because when different governments exist that are not getting along with one another, and they have those atomic bombs or hydrogen bombs, just at any time one can destroy another, and nobody is safe. Wendell Willkie wrote a book entitled One World after the war, and it sold 1 million copies right off. And that thing is being agitated now. There's a necessity for a worldwide government so that mankind may not destroy themselves. You see, things are shaping up for a final world power, and for that feast, things are coming to a head in our days. Have you stanza of a song?
Number 400.